Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Harmonize with me and hold me tight all through the night. You're shining bright. I'm your oyster, baby. You're my pearl.
Billy John Marco's here.
Hello. Hello, how are you? Sorry I'm not in the studio, but I see you've taken my chair.
It's very nice. Do people go on the floor normally when you're here?
We usually have a little a couch by the side there. Or would it be accurate to call it a bonquette?
I would call it a sofa.
Yeah, sofa, just on the side there for our guests. But since Billy's away, you've taken it.
And it's Billy, a lovely chair.
Billy's in your city, and you're in Billy's city. So amazing.
Yeah. What are you doing there?
I'm basically hanging out and watching shows and really, really sweating a lot.
Yeah, it's rough. Yeah.
It's really hot here just now. Were you here lately?
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing in Los Angeles?
Oh, I'm doing some stand-up comedy, taking some meetings.
Very LA.
Very LA.
Yeah.
Did they love you? Did they think you're hot?
Yeah. I just did.
Sexy.
Sure, but I think that helps if they think that as well.
Well, yeah, Billy and I talk about this thing all the time. The difference between a kind of casting audition meeting thing in the United States as opposed to Britain is in the United States, everyone loves you. So you'll get out of the meeting and you'll call your agent and say, yeah, it went pretty well. I look forward to hearing what they say. And your agent says, all right, cool, cool, I'll find out. And then they'll call back and say, they loved you. they think you are fantastic. You're like, oh, great.
Yeah.
You didn't get the part.
Sure.
Whereas in Britain, it's more along the lines of, there's a real kind of blunt transparency of, you know, they went in a different direction, or it wasn't really for them, or they're just much more frank and brutal. I'm not sure which one I prefer at this point, Bills.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's nice when people say they like you, even if they don't. It's just nice to hear that sometimes.
Yeah, you get used to this, like, slightly... to be honest, slightly disingenuous kind of vibe in the business that everyone loves you, because they can't all love you, you know?
Sure. We're both bullshitting. I'm taking a lot of these where they say, you know, what are your movie ideas, your TV ideas? And, you know, I got one line and I just go, oh, it's about family. And they go, ooh, interesting.
Oh,
can't wait
Diesel.
To see that pitch. And I go back home and go, oh, shit.
Right.
Gotta flush this out.
That supposedly is the Vin Diesel, the recent... Fast and the Furious film, which I've not seen. I only saw the first Fast and the Furious film. I'm not a big...
You're way behind.
I'm not a big...
26 now.
I'm not a big car person.
Me neither.
It doesn't do anything for me. But supposedly in the recent Fast and the Furious film, the whole thing is about family. We've got to protect the family. It's all about
and
the family.
Does he protect them by going fast?
He goes fast. Supposedly they drive... I don't know if this is true, but I think they drive a car so fast... that it goes into outer space
in one
of the films.
I think so.
I mean, Billy loves outer space, but driving a car into outer space? Surely the windows would crack, surely.
If somebody asked me, if I was in a meeting and they said to me, what is your pitch for a movie? I'd say, how about a car that goes so fast, it goes back to the future?
Oh, brilliant. What a brilliant name for a film. That could be the title of the film as well, Billy.
It could be.
To the future.
To the future.
Wow.
Just in a really fast car.
That's great.
I see that's opening as a musical over here now as well.
Is it?
Gianmarco, is that how you pronounce your name?
That's perfect.
Thank you very much. Tell me about New York City.
Oh, I've been there for a while. I grew up in Maryland, went up there a lot as a kid. I lived in Harlem for a long time.
Oh, nice.
Harlem.
Right.
Which, you know, Harlem, it's a historically black neighborhood. I lived across the new Whole Foods on Malcolm X Boulevard, which is what he would have wanted, I'm sure. And
yes.
I was there for a good 8 years, and now I live on the Lower East Side.
Oh, I lived in the Lower East Side for a little bit. I lived just near the Williamsburg Bridge.
I'm right by there.
Oh, really?
What were the cross streets?
Oh, my goodness. It was like over 10 years ago. I don't know, but when I would come out of my flat, if I turned directly right, it was like the walkway to the Williamsburg
Delancey.
Bridge. Delancey. Yeah, Delancey. That's exactly where I was.
We might live kind quite of close.
On the border of Little Italy, right?
Sure. I'm at Clinton and Rivington, which is right by the Delancey stop.
So Delancey was definitely the main street there. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know the cross street, but God, I love New York City. Billy's heard this story a million times, but one of my favorite ever live music moments was I was doing this film. And we finished kind of late, or at least it felt late, because it was wintertime in New York and it gets dark at like 4 o'clock, you know?
Yeah.
And I got dropped off a few blocks away from my house because I wanted to walk, because I love walking in New York. And it's freezing, like bitterly cold. And I was not wearing appropriate clothing. And I walked past this very small, very packed bar. And I thought, I'll jump in here, warm up, have a quick kind of nightcap and then head home. But I was like, why is this bar so full? And the bar was completely full because there was a guy on stage, on this tiny little stage, playing this tiny little miniature piano. And I couldn't leave. Like I was going to go and have one drink, ended up having two or three. Met the guy afterwards. He's called Chris Garneau, an amazing singer-songwriter, but playing on a tiny miniature piano about this big. And he has this like real high falsetto voice. Billy and Billy's wife absolutely loved him when I introduced him. Yeah. And that was just one of the moments, you know, those beautiful moments in New York. You're walking, you kind of get slightly lost. Suddenly you turn a corner and you're like, oh, that looks interesting. And you go in and love it.
New York's great.
Oh, yeah. Well, give Billy a recommendation of what you should do tonight.
I guess go to Katz's Deli. If you want like a nice Jewish meal. Like it's a Reuben sandwich, some matzo ball soup, where they'll treat you kind of roughly. They're a little gruff. You better know what you want when you get to the front of that line. They don't put up with any kind of shit. That's a good New York meal.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'll maybe do that. Is that on the Lower East as well?
Lower East Side, yeah. It's not too far from where we were at.
Well, I took my mom and dad there when they came to stay with me because it's almost, from where I was, I seem to remember, would you be crossing that big Delancey Street? And it's kind of...
Yeah, it's just a little bit north of that Delancey Street.
Yeah.
A couple blocks.
Oh my God, Billy, the sandwiches are like this.
It's amazing. Right. Go do that. Go to the Comedy Cellar. That's my home club. You want to see some stand-up? Go check that out.
But you won't be there, so what's the point?
Yeah, I know. They should just shut it down while I'm here.
So they should, actually. And so tell us about how often do you play there?
It depends how they're feeling about me. I mean, it is pretty volatile as a stand-up comedian. You just give your avails and you hope the big celebrities are... That's the problem with stand-up here in LA, is you try to get the major clubs here and the lineup is movie stars.
Right.
So people there's got a long line. Dane Cook's got to be sick for me to get up at the Laugh Factory.
And they tell you they've got a spot for you and you're ready to go, and then suddenly Chris Rock walks in to try something out and they're like, sorry.
Yeah, Marco, that happens to me at the Cellar, though. Chris Rock was running some stuff before his big tour. And sometimes they keep you there. They'll just extend the show, make it a 2.5-hour show.
Brilliant.
But sometimes you get bumped. And that's just how it goes in stand-up.
Now, as someone representing the stand-up comedian sect, and this might have been overly done a little bit by now, but how did you feel about the slap heard around the world?
I mean, it's bad. I haven't heard too many takes, many pro slap.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
No, it's bad. It was more just shocking, the lack of, I guess they assume it wouldn't happen. Most comedy clubs don't have security. You just think the Oscars would. But
who's going to stop Will Smith from going up on stage? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not a good look.
Yeah.
Every comedian, we deal with clubs where there's just no security at all. The security is there to enforce the bill being paid, not me being protected.
Mm. Yeah.
So I had one audience member after a show. This was not the Comedy Cellar, which has pretty great security, but it's called LOL. I keep naming it. I should be careful. But someone was mad at me and they were really getting in my face. And the security guard, instead of getting in between them, shoved the check near his hand to make sure that he signed for the bill.
Before he punched you.
Yeah, exactly. So it happens.
And do you remember specifically what the joke or the subject was that got on their nerves?
They were heckling, I'm sure, something political. If you're, this was like a if you, you've been to Times Square, this is the kind of show that they bark at people. They call barkers, yelling at people to come see the show. So these are people who did know they were seeing a comedy show that night. These are people who couldn't get tickets to Wicked and are wasted.
Yeah.
And they just found out their drinks cost $25 for a Heineken. And I think I said something to him. It's not a, I think something, oh, what's the actor? He was a firefighter. He's a real firefighter.
Steve Buscemi.
Yeah. Something about he looked like Steve Buscemi on meth, which already we're starting with Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
And then we're adding meth.
Yeah.
This was a rough look.
Yeah.
And they were mad about that. I didn't do it unsolicited, though. They were
heckling.
They were heckling. Oh, for sure.
And you have to shut down a heckler, right?
Yeah, it can be fun. If you have a heckler where, like, you shut them down and then they stop, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's ideal. But sometimes you have a lot of bachelorette parties. That's the most dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
A white woman in a plastic tiara, that's going to be the roughest.
And all her friends kind of going, you go, Elaine, you go.
Yeah. And it's just like, if you ask them to be escorted out, you got to be, as a comedian, you got to be cool. You got to be kind of funny, take it all in stride. The moment you kick someone out, you're a principal. You're authority. You're supposed to be making fun of authority.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a casino recently where there was a bachelorette party, and the code with the casino is you're supposed to say, oh, yeah, you look like you could use some water. And that's the code for them to come over there and take them out.
Get them
and
out.
No one did anything. Mm-hmm. So I was like, they really could use some water.
Mm-hmm.
Couple waters for this lady here.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, they said, oh, well, it looked like you were handling them pretty well. And I was like, well, that's my job.
Right.
Did you want me to fall into a ball, start crying? And then you go, oh, I think you need some help. So it's a tricky balance. They rarely kick people out of comedy clubs. You got to really be pushing it.
Hey, Tom, when you're running a business, it's difficult sometimes. You try to make everybody happy. Mm. You try to make a nice place for everyone to work. And it's not always easy. Take, for instance, somebody keeps coming to work and they absolutely stink.
Oh, no.
I mean, what do you do? Yeah. I tell you what you do. You better talk to Bambi.
Yes, with Bambi, get access to your own dedicated HR manager starting at just $99 per month. They're available by phone, email, and real-time chat, so onboarding and terminations run smoothly, team members reach peak performance, and your business stays compliant with changing HR regulations. And with Bambi's HR autopilot, you'll automate important HR practices like setting policies, training, feedback, all that kind of stuff.
Dom. HR managers can easily cost you $80,000 a year.
Is that right?
Yeah. But Bambi starts at $99 a month. That's fantastic. Schedule your free conversation today to see how much Bambi can take off your plate.
Go to Bambi.com right now and type in onion under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Spelled BAMBEE.com. Bambi.com. Type in onion.
Bambi matches you with your very own dedicated HR manager that you can easily reach by phone, chat, or email. Bambi's dedicated HR managers will know your business and your specific concerns. HR issues can kill you. One complaint against your company can turn your world upside down. You spend too much time dealing with HR when you should be spending your time on making a profit.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp.
Hey, Dom, you know sometimes you can get stuck on a problem and you can't find a solution because you're too busy looking at the problem.
Mm.
You're just going into a spiral, Dom.
Mm.
And sometimes you just need some help to get out of that. It can be tough to train your brain to stay in problem-solving mode when faced with a challenge in your life.
Mm.
But when you learn how to find your own solution, there's no better feeling. A therapist can help you become a better problem solver, making it easier to accomplish your goals, no matter how big or how small.
Mm. And also, as we know, therapy can be a little intimate. You can feel a little vulnerable going through the process, but The fantastic thing about BetterHelp is it can all happen online. So you don't even need to have a face-to-face conversation with a therapist if you don't need to. You can do it via phone. You can do it in your own way. And, you know, the intimate allows people to go through therapy without feeling so vulnerable about the experience.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're thinking about doing therapy, I would say BetterHelp is a great option.
I agree.
Because it's so convenient, it's accessible, it's affordable, and it's entirely online.
When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/onion today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/onion.
It's strange, right? Because as actors, you know, Billy and I have been exploring doing a play for a couple of years now, and at some point, hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll do that. But as actors, if Billy and I were on stage together doing a play, and someone in the audience even attempted to heckle,
sure,
it wouldn't even be something that Billy and I would have to do. Someone working for the theatre would come over and say, please don't talk, and if you talk anymore, you will be escorted out. But in a comedy club, sometimes people think they're part of the show.
More and more. And I think the problem is comedians these days, we really get our following off posting clips, and a lot of people's clips, because they might not want to burn their material online, will post these encounters with hecklers, and they can be fun, but then everyone gets conditioned to think, oh, that's what the show is. So people come to shows and they'll say, hey, it's my, you know, it's my mom's 80th birthday. Can you really roast her? Make her cry on this, the day of her birthday.
Oh,
but I started, I mean, I'm a theater kid originally. Right? So like, it's always amazing when, I think Patti LuPone, she's had a couple moments where she'll break out of the play to deal with what's going on. She yelled at someone for taking pictures, and I think the person ended up being with the New York Times, and they had been allowed to take pictures, but no one told
Patty.
Oh,
that's not good. Oh, gosh.
Patty suffers no fools.
Yeah, I did a
TV thing with her, and on the car coming back from set one time, it was like a little minivan, and she started singing show songs. It was absolutely amazing. I was asking the driver just to drive around for a while and we could just listen to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. What kind of play? You're going to do a play?
Yeah, we're thinking about it. I guess it's slightly under wraps because we're still trying to figure it out. But Billy is, you know... Shh, Billy, shut your face. Billy is in the center of the theater district in the United States. So he's kind of... you know, doing a little bit of groundwork for us. And, you know, we're talking to different places here and different places in London. It's weird. I mean, I started out same as you, and I'm sure same as Billy, started out doing plays. That was how I realized I really wanted to be an actor, was doing plays and doing years of plays at school and then outside of school and then at college. And not only is it when it's cracking off, my favorite medium to work in, but it is certainly my friend's favorite way to watch me work and my parents' favorite way to watch me work. But I've not done a play since I was 22. So like 20, almost 25 years ago.
I struggle with, I right when I switched kind of to stand-up comedy, I had a play that I wrote. And it was just me and one other person. And I started going crazy. It was my first like month-long run, 8 shows a week.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do new things so badly. I got bored.
Right.
People who do, you know, I've been Phantom of the Opera for 15 years. Huh. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I'd rather be broke. That is yeah. Tough.
Yeah, you hope that maybe you can find something in there. It might not be every night, but maybe, you know, during the week, you're like, oh, there was a couple of times where I tried this, it was working, or I'm going to use that tomorrow night and stuff, but I can understand the repetition. What about, I always feel like late night talk show hosts.
Sure.
You know, that medium of 15 or 20 years of monologue, guest, second guest, musical act, say goodbye, and it just goes on and on. That feels really tough to deal with.
It's tough, and I feel like, especially comedians... it's just the quality goes down. Because of course it does. I mean, you're getting there and you're finding out your cues, let alone writing comedy.
Right, right.
So I don't know. It seems like a thankless job.
Yeah. I'm trying to get Billy to watch the Larry Sanders Show, which is my all-time favorite TV show. And I think Shandling is a very underrated actor. Like, he's really great at that role. But to watch him go from, you know, kind of an interested, engaged, you know, he's not always excited, but sometimes excited talk show host, to getting threatened by the network and threatened by Jon Stewart and threatened, you know, annoyed by his, like, Hank and stuff like that. And then to watch him just kind of crumble, you know, and just get to a point where he's like, show's over. And then who am I when the show's over?
Yeah.
You know, it's a brilliant
show. He loved acting. Gary Shandling, if you watch all the documentaries, I think because he struggled with it more than comedy, he had like a real respect for acting, as opposed to like someone like Seinfeld, who really seemed to have a real resentment for the entire art form in general.
Seinfeld's an unbelievable stand-up comic. In fact, I've been looking into, he's doing a nationwide tour, and I've been looking into when he comes to LA, because I want to get tickets and see him in LA. Maybe, Billy, you can be my date if I get us a couple of tickets. That would be fun, right?
That would go. Yes, why not?
But yeah, Jerry Seinfeld can't really act, but Shandling, I think, is excellent.
Yeah.
Him, Rick Torn, and Jeffrey Tambor, that combination.
Amazing.
Incredible.
So how did it all start for you then, Gianmarco? If you're saying that you were a theater kid, New York?
Yeah, I went to college for musical theater, they kind of beat the joy out of. I don't think I was a singer. I've only been booked to sing these days at my grandparents' funerals. So it's only
four times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a bummer. It's I'm a good reminder. There's things worse
limited
than
limited run.
So I used to love musical theater, and then I moved to Philly. I was in like a Meisner based acting company slash cult. It really had the whole, whenever I see a cult documentary, I see the whole trajectory of this acting company from, worship of the leader starts to have flaws, crumbles, half the company loves her.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Or half the company's rebelling, chaos.
And then what happened to Meisner's voice box?
So Meisner was a big smoker, and I believe it was cancer.
Cancer of the larynx or something.
And so the only real video of him teaching, there's like 8 hours out there, they removed his voice box. So he's teaching, he's burping essentially.
Yeah.
That's how he's burping every word he does. And he's still smoking while he's doing all this.
I watched that during COVID. One of my things during COVID was it was something like a 12-hour lecture course with Meisner, and he had a whole bunch of students that he takes them through some exercises. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can watch this. But he does ask really interesting questions, and obviously he's like revered by his students, you know.
Yeah, he was the guy I was into the most. My uncle actually studied with him as a teacher. And I think there was like, he saw kind of the darker side of it. I guess Meisner had like some kind of island. He brought some of the male students he preferred.
Oh, goodness.
Just for some extra acting exercises.
Oh, God. Well, let's bring it back. Let's bring it back. Let's bring it back.
So, but I was a big Meisner guy.
He's great.
He's
really great.
Sometimes you get a lot of like, I don't know how deep in the weeds of acting we go here, but you know, it can be a lot of, I liked it because I like to yell. And a lot of those Meisner exercises, just addressing each other's behavior, ends with like, you're pissed, I'm pissed, you're pissed, I'm pissed.
Yeah.
And then every scene becomes just a fight.
There's a few moments in that course where he has like a duologue going on, and they'll be in the middle of talking, and then he'll stop them and he'll go, no, say it again. And the guy will say, whatever, I love you. No, again. And he'll go, I love you. No, again. And he'll try and get the guy to say it like 20 or 30 times.
Yeah.
And I guess he's trying to, whatever, stop the guy acting and just kind of say the thing, or maybe say it simply or something. But there's a few occasions where you can see the actors just turn around going, I've said it 35 times. What are you looking for? And he's like, again, again, again. Like, geez, okay.
It's one of those things with those older acting teachers. Sometimes I can't tell. It's like, am I learning a great acting technique or have I put this person on such a pedestal and they're old and in this case they have this voice that they make you emotional? Like, I did a master class with Larry Moss. He's still around. He's still teaching.
Right.
It's one of those things where he's just like an older guy. He's filling in for my grandpa or my father or something. But eventually they like do that kind of stuff and then you break down crying and you're like, wow, I learned.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh no, when I'm on set, I need an older man around here to tell me challenge. To repeat the line 30 times. And then when I get my like one line on Blue Bloods, I'm like, okay, we don't have that time right
now. Yeah.
What about you, Bills? When you were at college, who were the practitioners that you guys lent towards? I mean, obviously Stanislavski seems to be standard, right? But was there anyone else?
Nah, I never really bought into all the method stuff, you know, picking a method. I think, you know, it's for me, it was always just trying to find some truth. And you know, the Stanislavski thing, the only thing that really stuck with me was, I think he did a famous sort of exercise where he hides or something and they have to go and find it. And it was just that thing of like, if you have to find something, just actually look for it. Mm. You don't act that you're looking for something. Mm. Mm. Just look for something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that the simplicity of that sort of thing is really kind of what I was more interested in. I never really liked the idea of, you know, a method. I am now following this person's.
Yeah.
As you were saying, Gianmarco, that it starts to feel like a cult, you know?
Yeah,
And I think in not just in acting, but in spirituality or religion as well, I think if it all gets narrowed down to what one person says, then you're basically then trying to live the life that they lived that got them to that place.
Yeah.
But you've lived a different life. So you're not going to be in the same place. So you have to kind of, you know, grab what you can take. But I'm not one for saying, oh, I do this method.
No, me either. You know? Yeah, taking bits and pieces seems to be the way. There's a thing that I seem to use from Stanislavski quite a bit, which I think was called the imaginary if.
Mm-hmm.
Where if the scene were to end, what would that person do? I do think about that quite a bit with my work. So, you know, whatever, if I've had an argument with my wife in a scene and it ends in a crescendo of her saying, I'm going out, and she slams the door and the scene ends, I do quite often think, okay, so what would my character now do? Because if we see him in an hour, what has he done in that hour? Did he sit and meditate and now he's calmer?
Yeah.
Or did he drink three cups of coffee and when we see him later on, he's anxious and annoyed? So I think I do cherry pick that little thing from Stanislavski. But also the Brechtian stuff slightly confused me because obviously Brecht is all about this is a play, these are performers, these are actors.
Yeah, so
You can't do that in TV and film because you can't suddenly, I mean, sometimes you can break the fourth wall, but very often they want you to be that person. You can't be like, hey, here's a cameraman, here's a gaffer, here's a lighting guy. You know what I mean? It doesn't work.
I like that, an actor trying to be Brechtian on a film set.
Right.
We should write that. That'd be great.
I mean, Mike Myers did it in Wayne's World, right? There's some Brechtian stuff in Wayne's World where he'll chat and he'll be like, here's a moment of product placement. Here's the camera guy eating a slice of pizza. That's totally Brechtian stuff.
Yeah.
Whether he knew that or not, breaking the fourth wall, you know?
You know, I think all these techniques, I think ultimately they're supposed to be discarded. I left kind of Meisner and then I went full Strasberg and I was into that. And that was all the emotional stuff.
Right.
But I think that's because I struggled with that the most. That I was like, I think the thing you struggle with the most, same with Gary Shandling, that's why he loved acting, where you're like, this is it.
Right.
The thing I can't do. That's what I'm most fascinated by.
What's better than finding quality candidates? Finding them instantly. For a powerful hiring partner, you need Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for candidates with the right skills when you can do it all with Indeed. Find top talent with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like the Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews.
Oh, I love that about Indeed.
They make everything so easy. It's all in one place because there are things like Instant Match. Mm. Candidates you invite to apply through Instant Match are 3 times more likely to apply to your job than candidates who only see it in a search. That's according to US Indeed data. With Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a shortlist of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. Indeed does all the hard work for you. Sponsor a job, and boom, Instant Match shows you candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your job description immediately after you post. With Instant Match, you can start hiring fast.
It's true. Indeed knows that when you're doing everything for your company, you can't afford to overspend on hiring. Visit Indeed.com/onion to start hiring now. Just go to Indeed.com/onion. Indeed.com/onion. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application. Pricing not available for everyone. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Billy.
What?
I sometimes get a little bit nervous when I'm online buying things. And as we know nowadays, you tend to do most of your shopping online.
Yeah, no.
We're not going to stores anymore. So you're giving all of your bank details, sensitive information, sometimes makes me feel a little bit nervous between my family and my business life. I've got enough to worry about. I need the peace of mind of identity protection. But how do I do that? And what protection do I need? Well, how do I know?
Well, what you've got to do is check out Allstate Identity Protection, the best of identity protection from a brand that you can trust. So much of life is logging into our digital lives. That's why Allstate developed an identity protection product that protects your digital life just like they do your physical life. Mm. With Allstate Identity Protection, they'll reimburse up to $1 million for out-of-pocket expenses, lost wages, and legal fees. They'll also cover money stolen from your bank account, 401ks, HSAs, and tax returns.
At Allstate, they've been protecting the things people love for over 90 years. Not only will they monitor to help keep you safe, but should identity theft occur, their US-based customer service identity specialists provide expert support 24/7, 365, with an industry-leading 98% satisfaction score. Nice. Got a big or growing family? You can enroll your entire household under one family plan. That's spouse, kids, parents, in-laws, all for a flat rate that's less than you would pay for 2 individual plans and without the typical age or residency restrictions of where they live. Think the identity protection your bank provides is enough? Huh. Think again. The reality is that most financial institutions act only after fraud occurs rather than preventing it. Having comprehensive monitoring and coverage from AIP will help stop identity thieves in their tracks before any major damage is done.
Hey, Tom, what I love about Allstate Identity Protection is how easy it is to sign up. I went online thinking, okay, here we go. This is going to take a minute or two. It's so fast, and then you're protected online. It's a great feeling.
Yeah, I love that simplification. So when you think identity protection, think Allstate Identity Protection. To find out if your employer offers Allstate Identity Protection, head to AIP.com/onion. One last time, that's AIP.com/onion.
It sounds like you got, you know, quite deeply into kind of methods of acting and, you know, looked at it very closely. So how do you jump from that to stand-up? Or was stand-up always in the background?
It wasn't always in the background. I think I was comedic. I certainly, my generation in America, we really grew up in high school, and Dave Chappelle and Dane Cook were like the stars. Mm-hmm. Chappelle especially. And then, I don't know, you know, I think I ended up writing a play kind of as a vehicle for myself. And the play just had a lot of me talking to the audience, a lot of direct addresses. And I noticed from the feedback that people were raving about those parts and less about the scenes. And I just eventually had a friend who saw the play and was like, took me out to lunch and very seriously was like, you should focus on this. And it's just a different life. I was kind of a homebody. And to be a stand-up, you are giving up your nights. And I think I knew what it was going to be. If I was going to really be a stand-up, we're talking, at least in the beginning, every single night, out doing spots, 3, 4, 5 spots a night if you're really digging in there. And I was very scared, but once I started, I got really hooked. I think I need constant feedback emotionally. I like, if I'm writing something, I'm always like, can you look at this? Can you look at this? And with stand-up, that's what the whole show is. I get immediate feedback about a new line. And oh, that works. And oh, that didn't work. And I feel very much in the, you feel very much in the throes of the creative process. And you get the rewards immediately. And I think real stand-ups get addicted to that feeling where I can go somewhere and try something new and know that night if I'm onto something or not. And once you're hooked into that, everything else feels like the idea of writing a novel sounds insane to me, to write something this massive and wait.
Yeah.
And I think
you'd write a couple of pages and send it to someone. And
yeah, and with stand-up, I can write a sentence and essentially find out if it's good or not.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think a lot of what stand-up is, it's partly about do you love the art form, but it's partly like emotionally, what is your feedback loop system? And if I do acting now, if I do something more dramatic, I miss being able to know, did that kill? Did that crush? Did someone cry? But that's and once I was in, I was in.
And, so did that start in New York?
Started in New York. So like a lot of people start in smaller scenes, and it's kind of when you start in a smaller scene, you can become the king of or queen of that scene very quickly.
Maybe you can be the queen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You can open for big acts that are coming by. New York, you're automatically with some of the best of the best. There's some great stand-ups out in LA, but LA is, at least to New Yorkers, we'll say it's where comedy kind of goes to die.
New York's a little edgy, right? It's just, and it probably leans into that stand-up comedy vibe a little easier. There's just a little bit more of an edge on the street, a bit of a jumping.
Yeah,
sort of
that's
feeling.
Part of it. But part of it is just we're not taking generals during the day. You do a show here in LA, there's industry in the showroom. New York, that's not around very much anymore. So you're there to do stand-up. Mm. And there's a lot in LA that, yeah, I think there's a lot of big names out here, and you start getting busy, and stand-up becomes secondary. And the moment the stand-up becomes secondary, you can feel it. You can feel it in the specials. And it's so rare for stand-up comedians to find success and stay sharp. I think it's same with music or bands or anyone who becomes successful, but stand-up takes time. You cannot speed it along.
Yeah.
The George Carlins of the world, stand-up was always the priority. Mm. People like John Mulaney, shockingly, has maintained incredible skill and obviously just must spend time on it. Mm. So that's what happens. Mm. And that's kind of the reputation of folks that go to LA for the most part.
Let me create a little fictional construct here and see if you can answer this question. I'm putting you on the spot a little bit.
Please.
Here. Let's say you're in a stand-up club in New York, getting ready to go on. Mm. And some guy comes in, never done stand-up before, and they're going to go on for the first time. And they come over to you and they say, this is my first time doing stand-up. What three pieces of advice would you give me to do or to not do?
It's like a nightmare situation. I'm like, oh God, who let him in the green room? Why? Yeah, yeah. How did he get on this show? Why am I on this show?
There's only the two of you in the green room. You're fine. You're a pro. You're like, look, man, I've been doing this for years. It's a walk in the park. And they desperately say, it's my first ever show. Please just tell me what are the three golden rules of what I should or shouldn't be doing as a stand-up.
Well, the one thing I'll say is that I think because stand-up comics make it seem kind of improvisational, the writing, it's too late to give them to be like, well, write well. You need to be writing a lot. Stand-up, I mean, I'm a writer stand-up, so I am writing all the time. But if that's gone and this person's got whatever jokes they're going to do, I think there is that horribly generic advice of having fun. I believe that unless I'm enjoying it in some capacity, the crowd will not enjoy it too. And that doesn't necessarily mean smile and laugh around, but you have to be enjoying it up there. Right. So that'd be number one. Number two would be like, you have to take in the audience. They're your scene partner, for lack of a better word. You're not gonna let them have, hopefully they won't have any lines, but you gotta like take in the space that you are in. and see what's reacting. If it's a tough show, I will find the people who are digging it and I will feed off their energy, or I'll find the people that don't dig it and I'll try to really get them and find excitement in that process. So be happy, have fun. There's taking the room, taking the people. And then that writing would be the third one.
Right. Writing. You gotta have material.
Go look at the material in the couple minutes you have left before you go on. And then don't follow me. That's what I'd say most of all. Let me go before you so I can go home. But we have a lot of that. I mean, we have a lot of like fantasy football. People will do their leagues and the loser has to do stand-up comedy.
Wow.
And they headline a show because they bring 15 of their friends. Yeah. And it really is degrading to have your profession be kind of the punishment for losing a fantasy football league. Yeah. No one loses a fantasy football league and then has to go play Willie Loman for one night only on Broadway.
Right.
So that's the stand-up comedy is one of those things where we really dabble in, I feel like, the most disrespect of an art form. We were very valued at certain times, and other times we are treated like an animal act in a circus.
Do you feel that in New York there is a sort of, that some comedians sort of eat that up, that they almost like that? Like, you know, you're talking about the LA thing, and you know, you do a night in the right club at the right time in LA and you'll get, you know, you'll have your special, or oh, let's come in and talk about what movie you're doing. Whereas it feels like New York comedians, those guys, they don't want that. They're like, no, I'm going to this club where no one likes me and I'm going to do half an hour here. You know what I mean?
For sure. I think there's those comedians
guys
out there.
Smoking a cigarette.
They who knows, maybe they got the pilot, you know, their TV show with their name on it in the 90s and it didn't make it to air. But you see the comedians like Dave Attell, who I don't think he performs in places where he's hated, but Dave Attell is considered one of the like greatest comedians of all time. And he's not doing a lot of movies or TV shows.
Yeah, he doesn't have a face for movies, does he?
But these guys are the best, you know?
They're the best.
As you say, they've taken the time and it's just like everything just builds and builds, you know? The comedy is so kind of well-structured, you know? And you're like, but it almost seems like They're torturing themselves as they do it.
Yeah, you have to kind of want the punishment or the reward of a bit working feels so good. You're willing to deal with the rougher nights. Mm. But once you get addicted,
so what would be ideal for you? It feels to me like you enjoy writing it and polishing it.
I say all the time, best I feel is like when a new bit clicks in. Like, it's great to perform and do an hour of everything you know that works, but it's not as thrilling as being able to test something new or fine-tune something new. And that night when it goes, it's in, I did it, it's done. So I just like to be on stage. I've been starting to headline. So I think the ideal is just being able to perform longer sets. I'm tired. New York, you have to hop around, do 8 minutes here, 15 here, 10 here. That's exhausting. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather just do an hour a night or a couple hours on the weekend where I get to really explore. Every show you do.
In stadiums.
Sure. Stadiums feel not ideal for, again, like go back to like a play. You wouldn't want to do a long day's journey into the night in Madison Square Garden. That's going to be weird.
Sporting arenas and stadiums.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a big event, you know, it's much bigger, the feeling.
So I think like you do that if you can get to that level. But I think the real joy is like a smaller space. 50, 100, 150 people. It's harder though. The more famous you get, the more you're known, people start laughing or cheering. And that's like Chris Rock notoriously, when he goes to the Comedy Cellar and when they introduce him, people go
they
nuts.
Lose their mind.
They lose their mind.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are sat there going, we love comedy. We could easily have paid $200 to see Chris Rock, and we're paying $25 to see Chris Rock.
Yeah. You
know? So I'm sure they're stoked about that.
And he's right there.
I went there once and it was Chappelle went up and then brought Chris Rock on stage and they just did their thing for an hour and a half.
Brilliant.
And I just stand in the doorway watching.
Wow.
But once you get that big though, it's tough because like Chris Rock will take down his energy and will really talk. He'll almost purposely like make the audience cool. Because how else can you test material?
Yeah.
You can't test material. Yeah. Everyone's going crazy for you. And he's so famous.
They want your love.
He can't go anywhere without that kind of love or excitement or woo.
Much more famous now, probably, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that slap, I sold out his tour in a way.
Yeah. I'm assuming you've seen the Jerry Seinfeld doc comedian, right?
Of course. Because I just did Just for Laughs, which was what that was built around.
Right, of course.
And Orny Adams was the comedian featured in that.
It's just a really interesting way to deconstruct not only his act, but also what it means to be a stand-up. Because, you know, at his core, as we were just talking about, you know, obviously he had a hugely successful TV show. But as an actor, he's not necessarily the most skilled. It's him as a stand-up comedian where he really moves into his power. So to see him in that documentary start the show saying, okay, I'm going to completely destroy my act. I have no act. And then you're going to watch me build that act and the process of it and the angst of it, whilst also watching Orny Adams just losing his marbles during that film. It's one of my favorite docs ever.
I feel like I listened to a recent interview with Orny Adams. He was on WTF. And have you seen this documentary?
Yes.
Yeah. And so Orny Adams, for those who haven't seen it, like he was exploding on the scene and he was going to Just for Laughs and I think signed with like William Morris as he's going up there and everything's coming together.
Yeah, he was on magazines and newspapers, blah, blah, blah.
But his ego's out of control. And then apparently he kind of like bombed his JFL set. So Just for Laughs is like the place where all the industry is watching you. And he just like had a bad set and didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And I heard while he was on stage not doing well, he like talked to his agent from the stage. Like, can you believe they don't like me? And the agent was like, if you ever do this again, I will never fucking work. It's just like someone who, it just collapsed. And they're making a documentary about him before reality TV was big. So I think people don't, it was at that time people didn't realize that you could really make yourself look like a monster or an idiot.
Yeah.
And especially with the editing, make it look even worse.
It's excruciating. But my favorite moment in that entire doc, and I actually have used this a few times with people because it's just a great way to just have people maybe like check themselves a little bit, is Jerry Seinfeld is at a comedy store waiting to go on, probably like waiting half an hour or so to go on. And he's in the bar having a club soda or whatever. And then Orny Adams shows up and he's sweating and he's, you know, he's kind of like, he's, you know, rushed to get there. And Jerry's like, hey, how's it going? They obviously know each other. Hey, how's it going, Orny? And Orny's like, yeah, I'm good. It's just, you know, so frustrating. I'm trying to do this and couldn't do a set there. And then I raced across town. I only got 8 minutes here. And, you know, then this is going on and I can't get this person on the phone. And I want to move to LA, but I don't have time. And, you know, now I got to do this and I got to wait. And, you know, you're going to do your set and I have to wait. And Jerry Seinfeld's kind of nodding along. And he lets him finish his thing. And then Jerry says, do you have somewhere else that you need to be? And then he's like, what do you mean? He's like, if there's somewhere else you need to be, you should go do that. Like,
yeah.
And what he's saying is, you're a stand-up comedian. You're waiting in the wings to do your set. This is exactly where you need to be. This is your job.
Yeah.
And you can see him kind of get kind of bristle a little bit. And I just love how he called him out in a gentle, kind of playful way. And I've had moments like that with actors on set where they're moaning, oh man, it's cold and weather and I don't like the scene and lunch was rubbish and blah, blah, blah. I'm going to come here tomorrow and the call's at 7 a.m. and stuff. And I'm like, you have somewhere else you need to be? Like,
yeah.
You dreamt about being an actor when you were 8, 9, 10 years old. You're a professional actor. You're doing a great TV show. This is a fantastic role for you. Do you have anywhere else more important that you need to be right now? Because if you do, go do it.
Yeah.
And Jerry Seinfeld, have you run into Jerry Seinfeld over the years?
A couple times, yeah.
So how's his energy? Because he seems very kind of mellow about
stuff. He's mellow. I think it's just like, stand-up is we all have, there's hierarchies with all the systems. So Jerry's not the type, we're not going to sit down and have a conversation.
Yeah, he's up there, right?
He's up there. Mm-hmm. I did a show, it was at a place in New York called West Side Comedy Club, and I was hosting a couple years ago. And Jerry Seinfeld went on Twitter 30 minutes before, as he'll do, and basically said, doing a set at West Side, that's it. And he tagged West Side Comedy Club here in L.A. He tagged the wrong place. So West Side in L.A. had to release a statement saying, Jerry Seinfeld is not coming here tonight. Meanwhile, I'm on stage hosting this show that Jerry's about to go on. And Jerry didn't even issue a full correction. He just tweeted, in New York, period. So as I'm hosting, I think, on the Upper West Side, people found out, and all of a sudden, I'm hosting, and like dozens of yarmulkes, and I'm Jewish, dozens of yarmulkes start pouring in. All the Jews of the Upper West Side start pouring into the venue as I'm hosting. And they're so excited. And so, you know, Jerry gets there. I once said every time I see Jerry Seinfeld, if I come into a comedy club and I see Jerry Seinfeld on stage, I go, wow, I guess I'm going to be going up a couple hours late tonight, because that's what it means.
Right.
And it very quickly turns into, listen, again, I count your blessings. I get to see Chappelle and Chris Rock and Seinfeld. But the moment you see those people, you're like, oh boy, I'm not going up till 1:30 a.m. tonight.
Yeah.
Let me text the girlfriend.
Yeah.
No, Survivor tonight.
You like Survivor?
Oh, I'm a new Survivor.
Survivor is my all-time favorite TV show.
It started over the pandemic. So I've seen like 5 seasons, the last 2, and then 3 or 4.
Oh my
in
God.
The past.
We could sit here for another 3 hours.
Oh my God.
I love Survivor. I'm friends with Jeff Probst, the host.
That's so cool.
He's a really wonderful guy. He and his wife Lisa. And
you'd be good on that show, right? You could do that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. They've been trying to do a kind of whatever. I don't like this word, celebrity Survivor, for a long time. I mean, it's been like 10 years that they've been trying to do it. And Jeff's always been like, if we put it together, would you do it? And I'm like, dude, you're a buddy. Of course, if it was something helpful, I would do it. And there's a lot of people in the public eye that are huge Survivor fans.
Oh my God.
But unfortunately, and we're hoping to have Jeff on the podcast, and I think we will at some point. Unfortunately, because we've explored this as well, he's like, I think it kind of breaks the show, because if we do a celebrity Survivor show, it's going to be very hard then for people to tune in and go, well, wait, we wanted to see this actor who we like and this singer that we like and this, you know, musician that we like. We're not as interested in seeing, you know, people who, you know, are not in the public eye. I think, I mean, I'm going to like go off a little bit now. I think it's an extraordinary show, because you have the construct of the show, which is like, who is going to be the sole survivor?
Yeah.
And they base it around obstacle courses and brain teasers and all this kind of stuff, so the social game. But then you've also got multiple games happening inside the game, because the social game throws a lot of people off, and then maybe you have a love connection or two friends that betray each other, and ultimately you all have to betray each other.
Yeah.
So you've got 20 people saying, listen, I'm never going to betray you, but to win the game you have to betray 19 people, and then they have to vote and say we're okay that person betrayed us.
Well, that's what's amazing is like, sometimes they'll be like, you know, you lied, and it's like, well, yeah.
It's the game.
But some people, they lie in a way that people respect. Yeah. That's what's interesting.
Yeah.
Some people lie in a way that people go, you know what, I respect it. And other people lie in a way where they go, you're a snake, and I'm never voting for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I could deal with, and I feel like the earlier seasons focused on this, just the eating of wild animals. In like season 1, they caught a rat. And I am in New York. I see rats all the time. Sure. And I remember seeing rats. And every time I saw them for a while, I was like, could I?
Yeah.
Could I catch that giant rat and kill it and then eat it? And I'm like,
there's certain things that throw people off. I'm okay with stuff like that. I struggle with heights. I'm not great up high.
Uh-huh.
And if you expose yourself to that thing, then obviously at some point in the show, they're going to be like, okay, you're going to walk across a tightrope that's, you know, 80 feet in the air. And then you're going to climb a ladder that's, you know, goes up for like another 100 feet just to see how you do. That would kind of throw me off a little bit. All the other stuff is fine. Jeff Probst is pretty tight with Boston Rob. Do you know who Boston Rob is?
Uh-huh.
Because I think Jeff kind of feels like Boston Rob is arguably the greatest Survivor player ever. I probably think he's definitely in the top 3. And I've spent a little bit of time now with Boston Rob, with Jeff. And he is a really adept social, what's the word? Not manipulator, like engineer. Do you know what I mean? He's a lovely guy, but in a social situation, he makes sure that everyone feels like they've been seen and taken care of. He kind of connects with people if it's been a little bit of time. And there's been times where I've thought, man, I can understand how you would win Survivor. Everyone feels like they're seen by you, acknowledged, and then he's like, you want that last piece of chicken? They're like, oh, you want it? And he's like, yeah, I'll take it. And then he just takes it. And you're like, okay, I get it. I actually gave Billy my favorite ever
season of Survivor. And you've watched a few seasons, right, Bills?
No, I've never actually saw a season. I've watched a couple of episodes.
I love it.
But yeah, no, I need to apologize that you did give me your favorite ever season of it, and I lost it.
He lost it. Yeah, he lost it.
Oh, DVD. Yeah. We're talking about DVDs right now.
It's fine.
It's all on Paramount Plus now.
It was fans versus favorites. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
So so now you're not necessarily doing it in order, right?
Yeah,
you're just jumping
I jumped back. Around.
Did you do like best season of Survivor ranks type thing?
I did. Yeah, I have friends who like, I had a friend who like made a document of where to start. And they talk about like, they say the Australia Survivor is tremendous.
It is. It's great.
And there's like a New Zealand. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah. I don't think
it's so much. If there was ever another pandemic,
yeah,
which probably.
Yeah, sure.
I think I could consider like, let's just do it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just do it all.
Well, check out my favorite one, and a lot of people's favorite one seems to be fans versus favorites. So you've got favorite people coming back.
Yeah.
And then super fans going up against them. There's a really interesting guy in that called Rupert. He kind of looks like an old grizzled kind of pirate.
Rupert from oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I just watched,
he's got like
I just watched the pirate
guy,
season.
Kind of talks like
he's amazing. Yeah. He was like, they voted him off, but he was amazing.
He's a lovely guy. Oh. And he has a really fun season on that. That's fun. Talking of which, it says in your bio that you do a fantastic Jeff Goldblum impression.
Yes. I got a couple. I always got him. What it was, Jeff, I'm sure you've met him. So he's Jewish.
You also slightly look like him, right? Which helps.
I think a little more than slightly. I try to distance it now. But if I, you know, yes. And I think Jeff, so like, if you look at like the Woody Allen type, you know, he has the stutter.
Sure.
And Jeff somehow took the Jewish stutter and he elongated it and somehow made it sexy. And it's an incredible contribution to the Jewish culture.
I love it. He's quite an accomplished jazz musician, right?
Is it
piano that he plays?
Piano. Or? He tap dances.
Tap dances.
He does a show. I've never met him. I played him. I was in this Billy Crystal movie where it was like a SNL type show, and right. I did a Jeff Goldblum impression on that show. And I was like, God, how do I get this back to Jeff?
Yeah, yeah.
Just so I can play his son and something.
I think I did meet him once at some show. And that thing that he did with his hands is very interesting, Jeff Goldblum thing. But what it feels like to me with Goldblum when I watch him is because he's so well versed in jazz as a musician, and he's aware that jazz is an element of just keeping things going, you know, keeping the piano going, keeping the instrument moving, kind of, you know, waiting to see what the other players are going to do. And in the meantime, just keeping everything going. It feels like when he speaks, that's what he's doing. He's just you asked me a question. Let me think here. I'm going to go here. So all those little
affectations. And there's notes that don't really make sense,
yeah.
But they had.
That's very good, man.
Billy and Dom eat the world.
Welcome once again to Billy and Dom eat the world. Now, Gianmarco Soresi, would that be a correct pronunciation, would you say?
Soresi, but Soresi is so close.
Soresi?
Soresi, like crazy.
Soresi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Right, so that to me doesn't sound like a Japanese name. You could correct me if I'm wrong.
You're right on.
Would you be Italian?
Italian, but just a little. My dad exaggerated it. My mom's Jewish, but my dad,
right?
My dad acted, raised me as if I were 100% Italian. Mm. And then one day I went to Italy and I said, where's the family? And he had trouble naming any. They exist. Over the pandemic, someone from Sicily, a distant cousin, reached out.
Oh, lovely.
To talk about my great-grandpa Luigi, who was like a manager for boxers. So, yes, but more Jewish.
Or even Jewish food. You're giving us noodles, ramen noodles.
Ramen noodles. Well, my parents got divorced when I was just a babe. And when you have a single dad, one dish that is heavily relied on is ramen. Mm. And so for me, if I'm thinking about my culture, it is a culture of single fathers. I went back and forth, but at my dad's, this is what I ate every single day. And this is part of my heritage in its own way.
And was it like this sort of top ramen?
That is exactly what it was.
Oh, I love top ramen.
Exactly what it was.
It is incredibly tasty, isn't it?
Oh, it's the best.
But Billy, have a look on the back of that packet.
What?
Have a look at how much sodium. This is why it's so tasty. Look how much, I think it's something like 40 or maybe 50% of your daily sodium is in that one thing.
So let's have a look at how much sodium's in this, Dom. Sodium, there is 1,590 milligrams, which is 69% of your daily what you need.
So
a couple of packets of this.
So if I had two of those a day, that's too much.
Yeah. So almost 70% of the salt that you should be eating is in that tiny little packet, which makes it super tasty. But top ramen. It's hard to beat top ramen.
The best.
What are you having, Bill? Are you having top ramen or are you having something else? Because we're having...
No, because I wanted to get top ramen because, my son, my son was growing up, he loved top ramen. But only if my wife made it. He said that she made it better than me.
Well.
Which is kind of weird because there's not much to the making of it, you would think. So I got this one because I could just throw some boiling water in it and then it's ready to go. But what have you guys
got? We've got like a fresh ramen, which is very, very difficult to eat. But
thick noodles, very thick noodles. This is definitely thicker than what you got there.
They're all kind of cooked together. Well, you guys got like fancy? Is it like expensive noodles you guys have got?
I don't know.
I think it looks pretty nice.
Oh, it's actually tasty once you get hold of it.
It's at a nice room temperature. Just a little bit of warmth. Echoes of warmth.
I'm assuming ramen has its own kind of scene vibe in New York City, right? It's kind of a go-to thing.
Yeah. You feel like you get some authentic...
Kind of late night after the comedy club ramen vibes.
That's the perfect meal to have.
Mm. It's super yummy.
And I think when you eat it, you're supposed to suck in some oxygen.
Oh, aye.
Well, I watch a lot of anime and manga. I read manga and watch anime. And like in all the anime, all the characters, they bring it up. Mm. They're slurping it. It's an aggressive eat. Mm. And I do like that. I feel like in America, you're not supposed to sip from the bowl. I still sip from the bowl.
Yeah, I like that too.
You need the oxygen. You need this.
Oh, really? Lovely. Lovely. like a true professional. I've been
And it tastes better.
Yeah, it does taste better because you've oxygenated it. I've been threatening with myself to watch this animated film on HBO for a few nights now. I've still not got around to it. It's called Bella. Did you see this thing?
No.
I think, Billy, you'd like this too. Watch the trailer. It's about a girl who, when she kind of gets herself into the virtual reality metaverse, her superpower, if you will, is her ability to sing. She has an angelic voice that like completely throws people off and has people do things for her. So it's kind of a half anime, half musical. Which I remember thinking, gosh, Billy will love this. And supposedly the visual kind of graphics and computer-generated images are insane. I've been trying to watch it for the last three nights and I keep getting distracted playing video games instead, but I'm going to watch it.
Sure.
And I think you'd love it, Bills. HBO, Bella.
It sounds good.
Mm.
Bella, I'll watch that. Sean Marco, oh, geez, just lost my headphones. Do you still sing? It sounds like the musical theater world has destroyed your love.
I love it in its own way. I sing in the shower, and I was like, I probably do more vocal warm ups than any stand up comedian in the world does because it just feels like home.
Right,
a lot of scales. I love it. I hope someday I can succeed enough as an actor that they put me in a musical, even though I'm not qualified anymore.
Mm.
That's just like a Mamma Mia 10 by that point, I would think. There's a couple musicals I would like.
I think you'd be brilliant.
I would love to do. Where would you do you musical theater? Any favorites?
Well, as a kid growing up, obviously you do the, well, in Britain at least, it seems you do the standard kind of Oliver, Wizard of Oz, Bugsy Malone, which I did all those, Artful Dodger, Tiny Tim, Scarecrow. Billy actually turned my head to musicals as a grown-up. I was very snobby, to be honest, about it. I was like, ah, musicals, not really my thing. I'm into more kind of, you know, kind of realistic acting without breaking into song. And Billy's like, well, you're kind of missing out because there's some incredibly emotional things to watch out there.
Yeah.
And Billy kind of kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me to go see Les Miserables, which I did in London. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't realize how much I was missing out. And since then I've seen, you know, Matilda, and Billy's in New York. He just saw Book of Mormon. And you've seen Hamilton tonight, Bills.
Book of Mormon was fantastic.
So good.
I have to applaud the cast. It was one of the best casts I've ever seen on stage. There wasn't a weak link. Mm. They were absolutely amazing. And the energy and it was just, I was very, very impressed.
Those guys are geniuses. Have you seen the South Park movie way back a long time ago?
The bigger, longer, uncut thing?
Yeah, which was a musical.
Yeah.
And Stephen Sondheim wrote them and said, this is the best musical of the year.
Wow.
Whatever. I mean, they really respect the craft.
They love musicals.
They're astounding.
They? Yeah.
They're astounding.
Very, very funny. And then you're off to see Hamilton tonight, Bills. Brilliant. Which has one of my favorite emotional songs in it. Is it called Uptown, where they move? Remember they move uptown after his... Have you seen Hamilton before, Bills?
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, really?
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it's Quiet Uptown, right?
Uh-huh.
So
is it?
Well, you tell me tonight, Bills. But yeah, there's a song in it called It's Quiet Uptown. My God, incredible. Well, I'm going to read... Bills, do you want to read this first blurb about ramen so that we can see if we can...
people
interested.
As is de rigueur for our Johnny, he's given us quite a lot, but I'm not sure if any of it makes much sense.
Well, I like it.
But let's have a go.
Yeah, try the first paragraph. It's all right.
The origins of modern ramen. The first Chinese noodles served in Japan weren't called ramen at all. They were known as shina soba. Shina is an archaic Japanese word for China, and soba was a catch-all term for any noodles found in Japan at the time, though it usually referred to buckwheat noodles. Because of its offensive connotations, the word shina eventually fell out of use and was eventually replaced by ramen, which likely came about from the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese term liamen. The word liamen comes from la, which means pulled, and mian, which means noodles. Pulled noodles.
Wonderful.
There you are, Tom.
Well, I thought that was very, very good. And then I'm just racing through some of this stuff now. Says ramen really became mainstream in 1958, courtesy of Momofuku Andu, inspired by his decade-old memories of a makeshift ramen stand. He believed the cheap working class meal was a perfect fit for Japanese pantries. It's kind of become, for me at least, one of the things that I have as a little bit of an emergency thing in my cupboards. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because if worse comes to worse and you need that midnight snack, or you've forgotten to go get eggs or something, you're like, oh, I've got nothing in the house. There's always a few packets of ramen in the back there, and you think, oh, I'll just quickly have some.
That's in the bomb shelter for sure. It lasts forever. Mm. I've moved like a second time, and I'm like, I'm moving this ramen to a third location because I've just had it forever.
Wow.
Just as a backup.
Yeah, that's great.
So let's have a look at, like, this packet that I've got just now is okay until the 10th of June, 2023.
Yeah, that's...
That's all right.
It could go further than that.
I think it could go further than that as well. It's a dehydrated noodle, right? So what? There's nothing that's going to go...
But we don't know how long that's been sitting in the CVS.
You're right. That could have been there.
That could have been in there since the war. Mm.
There's a picture of Nixon on the front.
We like to give it scores. And how we do the scores here is we give it out of 10, and you're allowed decimal points. And the first thing we score it on is taste.
Mm, let me get a little bit more.
So, first things first, what is the taste score out of 10.
Well, Billy...
Gianmarco, I think you should go
first.
Yeah,
let's have Gianmarco go first. But Billy, can I just ask, what is the actual flavour of that ramen pot that you're eating? Because I think ours was just a veggie
sweet
ramen.
Sweet chilli, Dom. That's a
sweet chilli.
Mine is a sweet chilli style stir fry. It's on the hot scale, it's only got one pepper.
Not that hot, then.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Flavor. Out of 10.
Well, the first thing I say was delicious. I was thankful for the meal. Mm. It was kind of the base. Like, this is the ramen you want to add some stuff to it.
Yeah, a bit of spice.
Yeah, so it definitely had the ramen base, but definitely not. I like a little sting.
Mm.
I like a couple peppers on there.
Okay.
I like to have a ramen meal.
Yeah, you want a few peppers.
Yeah, I like a ramen meal that, like, it would be tough to continue the podcast as I was eating it, that I was in so much pain.
Yeah. Do you add stuff like that momofuku, that chilies? You put some chilies
in there. I'll add an egg. I love an egg.
Well, lovely.
Yeah, stick an egg on it. Why not?
Soft boiled, so it just kind of leaks into the sauce a little bit.
I mean, when I eat cup of noodles as a kid, I would just douse it in Tabasco sauce. It was the spiciest meal. Mm. And I would be crying by the end.
Yeah, I like my ramen sometimes to make me sweat.
Yeah.
Mm.
Sweaty ramen.
So this wasn't a sweaty ramen. So maybe you'd dock a few points for that.
Yeah, I would dock a few points. But it definitely felt like this would be a good starting place.
So out of 10. And you can give decimal points if you want.
Yeah, I'll give it a 7.2.
Okay, 7.2. Wow, that's probably... Yeah. What about you, Bills? I mean, yours is different from ours, so...
Yeah, well, if we're scoring this one, like, it's not as good as my usual ramen. But I'm still going to give it a 7.5.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very positive.
Dumb.
Very positive, that William Boyd. Yeah, I'm about the same as you. I'm like, I like there to be a combination of flavors. Some dried onion, maybe some spring onion, an egg, a little bit more tofu, some spice. It's a 7 for me.
My girlfriend, she'll add some corn. Oh, yeah. I do love corn.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Corn's good.
You seen that new clip? I think it was on TikTok, which Billy's obsessed with, about the little kid whose favorite thing in the world is corn. Have you seen
What is he saying?
It's just so cute. They seem to be at a fair or something, and this guy's obviously hit upon this great opportunity to talk to this kid who is over the moon about corn. And the guy's like, why do you like corn? And the kid's like, what's not to like? You put butter on it. It's amazing. It's super tasty. It's good for you. It's healthy. It's my favorite thing ever. You can put it in your pocket. He like puts it in his pocket and takes it out.
That's the real plus. It's like, transport.
That's the plus. Right,
I had some friends from Australia, and when they visited me in America, they were shocked because they don't really do corn over there.
Oh, right.
I don't think, because corn, you know, it's I think it's American.
Well, yeah, maize is huge over here.
And they were like, the fact that it was served as a side on its own shocked them.
I was saying to Billy, I've said this before, why is it called corn on the cob and then loose corn is called corn? Surely the way that it comes au naturel should be called corn, and they should call the other stuff corn off the cob.
Corn, you know, off the cob, sure.
That should be, because the way that it shows up in real life should be the base level. That should be corn.
Yeah.
And then you're like, how are we serving the corn tonight? Oh, we're having corn off the cob. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Feels weird to do it the other way around, but... Anyway. Wait, what was that? What's our second category, Bills?
Aesthetics or looks? How does it look to you? Is it, you know, does it get the juices going as well? We're saying
ramen's tough to go. Ramen's tough to go. It's all just becomes a clump in there. A
little bit.
So in terms of... It's not the worst. This was a good bowl, like in terms of for a takeout bowl.
Mm-hmm.
But I gotta give it a 5.
Yeah,
when it's in that wooden bowl and you got that spoon. I don't even really use the spoon, but just having that weird shaped spoon, that big oval spoon. That's a good feeling.
And like you said, if there's an egg in there and it's kind of orangey and maybe not fully cooked and it's kind of leaking into the soup, and then you got spring onions and all that kind of stuff. Color. The cool thing about the noodles here is that they're kind of like a nice kind of spinachy green, and I like it. But yeah, ramen generally is not necessarily the best presented meal. I'm going to give it I'll be kind. I'll give it a 6.
That's nice. I also like to do like pretend as if I'm going to use chopsticks and then after 3 bites go, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to just use a fork.
Bills, how's yours?
I'm going to give it a higher score because I agree that it's not maybe not the nicest looking thing, but I think when you look at it, you know it's going to be okay. This meal's going to be okay. It could be fantastic, but it's going to be okay.
Mm.
You know, so
reliable.
I'm going to say aesthetic because it does get my juices going, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a 8.
Oh, William. Ooh, nice scores. It's one of my favorite versions
now, guys,
of Billy is when his juices get flowing.
Exactly. The next one, which I think I'm feeling as if it could score quite high here, is how useful is it? When it's in the cupboard and, you know, maybe all you've got is that, an egg, a couple of chilies. Maybe you've got a breast of chicken. I don't know what's, you know. But how useful is ramen in your life?
I got to give that a 10, especially when I think about the money. Because it is cheap.
Yeah. Cheap.
It is, I think, for bang for your buck, nothing beats ramen.
Yeah.
Like, it's stupidly cheap, isn't it? Like, you get a box of it for like $5 or something. Yeah. Like, how do they make money? What is it made? What is it?
It's almost made of nothing, isn't it, really? And like Billy said, you can add so many things to it. It can just be a side dish if you want. You can have your food, and then you can serve it almost like a pasta or a rice. Or you can have the ramen actually be the whole meal. And you just put a whole bunch of veggies and meat in there. And probably one of the most perfect nuclear fallout shelter things to have, right?
And if you stick extra water in it, you've made yourself a soup, dog.
Oh, exactly. I like that. You can put it in a thermos.
You can have it dry. You can have it wet. Yeah. No, Dom, it's got to be high. It's got to be a high score. And I'm going to give it a 9.8.
Wow. Almost a perfect score. Yeah, I'm with you guys. I'm in the same place. I'll say... I mean, the liquidy thing, my thing is always like, can you put it in your pocket and take it to a football game? With it being liquid.
You love corn then? That's why you like corn so much?
That's why I like corn. You just,
yes.
It's not quite as perfect for travel. Although in a thermos, it's amazing. I'll give it a nine.
Well, I think that's good. It's high scores all round for your top ramen.
I will.
Lovely stuff.
Have you ever been to Japan, Gianmarco?
I'm dying to go. I have not.
So the only thing that I will say in terms of ramen in Japan and then obviously coming back here is it almost spoils it here because the ramen in Japan is so good.
Yeah.
They do something, whether it's with the water or with the noodles, and there's a lot of places where you show up and before you go into the restaurant, there's a kiosk and a kind of electronic kiosk, similar to something that in the States you might get a kind of fizzy soda out of or a candy bar, and you click, you know, I want ramen with extra noodles, 2 eggs, spring onion, blah, blah, blah. Then you walk into the restaurant and you sit at a booth and then a little slide opens and then they push it through. There's no staff, nothing like that.
I love it.
And that ramen, like when I went to do Wild Things, we had all these opportunities to go to different places and every night we'd just be like, should we just go back to that ramen place? Because it was unbelievable. So it almost ruins it in Japan because it's so good. So you need to be conscious of that. You know?
Yeah.
But
you should do a tour.
Oh, that'd be the dream.
You should get over there.
I'm working.
I think they think...
Working. Yeah. Get big enough.
You could maybe do it in Japanese.
Sure.
I might take a bit of work.
Sure. You know, it'll take quite a lot of work, I think. A
couple of years.
It's tough. Stand up in other languages. I mean, I know people who are bilingual and still don't necessarily do language in their second language because it's just hard. The syntax is different. So especially like comedically, I mean it's kind of a dumb but obvious rule where like the funny part of the twist is at the end.
Right.
And you have a language where you do the adjectives after the noun or anything like that. It changes it.
Yeah.
Changes it.
Well, do you know Eddie Izzard? I'm sure you do, right?
Yeah.
Izzard does a show in, I believe, French, Spanish, Russian, Arabic, Italian. I mean,
that's just a genius.
I mean, I do think
I can't
Eddie
speak
Izzard,
a single other.
Eddie Izzard does have an element of genius to their personality. But that is, like you said, to be crazy. Funny, but then also to understand the construct of the language, to be able to be funny in a different language, not just to be understood, but to be funny. That is extraordinary, man.
Yeah.
What a talent. Well, Gianmarco, it's been amazing to have you on. Is there anything in particular
really
that you
fun.
Want to tell people out there in terms of where they can see you or what you're
yeah.
up to?
Yeah. Well, find me online at Gianmarco Cerezi on all the platforms. If you want to see me live, that's where I post my tour dates and all that jazz. I have a podcast called The Downside, where I interview folks about, we celebrate the negativity. We find
oh.
the, you know, we have people complain and kvetch, to use a Jewish word.
So it's an opportunity for people to come on and talk about the things that get on their nerves.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, fun.
And sometimes we have, you know, particularly, we just had someone who worked at a morgue and, you know, talked about the downsides, of which there are many, of working at a morgue.
No, there must be. Oh, yeah.
So it's a fun, if you like that kind of stuff, if you like to complain and bitch and moan, come listen to that, The Downside with Gianmarco Cerezi.
I'll come on and I'll talk about people having the clicky button on their phone on.
That's the kind of stuff we love
what
to talk
is,
about.
What is that about? Who is that click for? You know you're typing, so you don't need the click. Are you telling other people that you're typing?
Yeah.
My mum and dad do it all the time. So we're sat watching something. I just hear my mum and dad in the back going, who's that for?
Sure.
It makes no sense. I actually think that the phone itself should just take it out. It shouldn't be an option anymore. I don't understand why we need it.
I think that it's nostalgia.
Ugh.
It's nostalgia. And I see the ways that now that I'm getting older and the things that I do miss. Like, for example, I think about all the time how menus have kind of gone away.
They have, yeah.
And I miss menus. But I feel like if you were to explain it to someone who never had menus, they'd go, you want a dirty piece of paper that's been passed around? And I'm like, yes. And for your parents, that sound.
Maybe it's that.
And one of the things I hate is people who leave before the end of a conversation, but I'm going to be that guy because I'm off to see Hamilton.
Yes. Brilliant.
And I'll miss my ticket.
Have a fantastic time. Say hello to the family, Bills. I'll see you sometime soon. Hey, guys, we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Obviously, you know how to get hold of us on our YouTube channel, and you can send messages on our voicemail. That's the Friendship Onion at speakpipe/. Oh, I've got it wrong. What is it, John?
Speakpipe.com/ The Friendship Onion.
Did they hear that, John, or do I need to repeat it? They absolutely heard it. Please rate, review, and subscribe to us. Let us know anything in particular that you want us to eat, or maybe a guest that you think would be great on the show. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to do a fan art special episode. So if you send in all your fan art now for the next few weeks, we're going to pool it all together and Billy and I will sit around and we'll open up the fan art and we'll hopefully put it on some of this negative space that we have behind us here. I can't do the hand thing because it's backwards. Here, above me here and above Gianmarco's head. We'll put all of your work here. So send us in your fan art. We'll put the address of the studio in the show notes and we'll see you guys next week. Toodles!
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.